This meeting is now being recorded.
I would now like to turn the floor over to GIH President and CEO, Lauren LeRoy. Lauren?
Thanks, Anne. I'm calling in from New York, so Anne and I and Othula Rushing are going to do a little bit of tag team work here because I'm not where the technology is to manage the webinar. But I'm very pleased to have so many of you on the call today and to have the Council on Foundations as our partner for this call. The health funders on the call know that GIH has been actively involved in programming and supporting grantmakers' work on health reform in the years leading up to enactment of the Affordable Care Act and since that time. Needless to say, we were all waiting eagerly or perhaps anxiously for the Supreme Court decision to remove some of the uncertainty about the future of the ACA, although we obviously know that we're going to have to wait for the November election results as well. Nonetheless, there are aspects of the decision that were not necessarily anticipated, and there have been multiple interpretations in the limited amount of time since the decision about the implications of these various elements within the decision itself. And so I consider us very fortunate to have some of the nation's leading experts with us today who will walk us through the most important points we need to know and what we can expect going forward as much as they've been able to tune into their crystal balls. Our speakers today are Mary Beth Musumeci, who's a senior policy analyst at the Kaiser Family Foundation, Sarah Rosenbaum, who is, among other things, Harold and Jane Hirsch Professor of Health Law and Policy at George Washington University, and Alan Weil, the Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. Before they begin, I want to turn over to Jan Gallagher, who is the Council on Foundations General Counsel and Senior Vice President, just to say a few words of welcome as well. So, Jan, on to you.
Thank you very much, Lauren, and I'd like to join Lauren in welcoming you to this very important call. We're very happy to be able to co-sponsor this with grantmakers in health because we know this is an issue of significant concern to many of our members. So welcome to the call.
Thank you. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Mary Beth, Sarah, and Alan.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Thanks. So I'm going to take us through the slides to give us an overview of what the court decided. So on this first slide, this depicts the major provisions of the ACA, and as you know by now, Congress's stated goal in enacting the ACA was to increase access to affordable health insurance. And the law seeks to accomplish that by a number of means, building on the base of employer-sponsored coverage with health insurance market reforms and the equitable mandate, which is the requirement that people maintain minimal essential coverage or face a penalty that the law calls the shared responsibility payment. And there are some people who are exempt from the mandate and others who are subject to the mandate but exempt from paying the penalty. Secondly, the law provides for health insurance exchanges, which will be marketplaces through which people can purchase qualified health plans and also gain access to advanced payment of premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions. And then thirdly, the Medicaid expansion, which would cover nearly all people under age 65 up to 133% of the federal poverty level beginning in 2014 with 100% federal funding from 2014-16 and then gradually decreasing 90% federal funding prospectively. This slide shows the positions that the states took in the litigation. So a group of 26 states led by Florida filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of both the individual mandate and the Medicaid expansion. At the Supreme Court, there were 13 states that filed briefs supporting provisions of the ACA. And you can see the states in light blue actually were on both sides of the case as their governor and attorney general took opposite positions. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in the Florida case struck down the mandate, severed it from the rest of the law, allowing it to stand, and upheld the Medicaid expansion. So the case reached the Supreme Court, and the court agreed to determine four issues. First, whether the courts had jurisdiction to decide the constitutionality of the mandate now. If so, is the mandate constitutional? And if unconstitutional, is the mandate severable from the rest of the law? Separate from those questions, the court also agreed to determine the constitutionality of the Medicaid. So on June 28th, the court issued its decision, and the only unanimous point was that the court did have jurisdiction to hear the case now. This issue raised was due to the Anti-Injunction Act, a federal law that bars suits that seek to restrain the collection of taxes before they're assessed and due. And by its terms, it applies to taxes, not to penalties. The court, in its analysis under the Anti-Injunction Act, determined that Congress called the shared responsibility payment in the law a penalty, not a tax, and therefore the court would defer to Congress's terminology and determine that the Anti-Injunction Act did not apply. However, the court then went on, a majority of the court went on to find that the mandate is constitutional under the taxing power. And the court explained this by saying that while Congress's decision to label the shared responsibility payment as a penalty controls for Anti-Injunction Act purposes, it is not determinative in the taxing power analysis. Rather, the court looked at what the shared responsibility payment does and determined that it looks like a tax. It's administered by the IRS. It's reported and paid on federal tax returns. It doesn't apply if you aren't required to file a tax return, and it's calculated based on factors such as the income, the number of your dependents, and tax filing status. In addition, the penalty raises at least some revenue, which is, the court said, the essential feature of a tax. Even though it does seek to influence behavior by encouraging people to buy insurance, it still functions as a tax, because it leaves people with the lawful choice to not buy insurance as long as they're willing to pay the tax. There were two other arguments advanced by the federal government, that the individual mandate was constitutional under Congress's Commerce Clause power or the Necessary and Proper Clause power, but only four justices would have upheld the mandate on that basis. So the court then did not have to determine whether the mandate was severable from the rest of the law because a majority upheld under the taxing power. However, the four dissenting justices rejected the constitutionality of the mandate on all bases and therefore would have invalidated the entire ACA as a result. Turning to the Medicaid expansion issue, this required the court to look at Congress's power under the spending clause. Congress has long had the authority to place conditions on federal funds that it grants to states to ensure that the funds are spent according to Congress's conception of the general welfare. And in this case, for the first time, the court found that a condition placed by Congress on federal funding to states was unconstitutionally coercive. The Medicaid Act since 1965 has had an enforcement provision that gives the secretary discretion to withhold all or part of a state's federal Medicaid matching funds for state noncompliance with federal rules. And a majority of five justices held that the secretary may not withhold existing federal Medicaid funds for state noncompliance with the Medicaid expansion. However, the secretary's existing authority to withhold Medicaid funds for state noncompliance result that the ACA's Medicaid provision survives in the law, but the secretary's enforcement power is constrained. So states have the financial incentive to comply with the Medicaid expansion due to the enhanced federal matching funds available, but the penalty for state noncompliance is limited to the loss of Medicaid expansion funds. So this chart summarizes the vote breakdown in the case. Unanimous that the court had jurisdiction, a 5-4 split that the mandate is constitutional under the taxing power, a 7-2 division finding that the Medicaid expansion violated the spending clause power as unconstitutionally coercive of the states because the states were not given notice to voluntarily consent, an adequate notice, and because all existing program funds were at risk. and then a 5-4 split holding that the remedy for that unconstitutional violation was to limit the secretary's enforcement power. So looking ahead, these next two charts give you a sense of where the states are today in terms of Medicaid coverage. So for working parents, as of January 2012, 17 states only cover working parents with household incomes below half of the poverty line. 16 states cover working parents between 50 and 99% of poverty, and 18 states, including the District of Columbia, cover working parents at the poverty line or above. And turning to the next map, coverage of low-income adults is even more limited. Low-income adults do not have Medicaid coverage at all as of January 2012 in 26 states, and only 8 states, including the District of Columbia, offer coverage that is comparable to the rest of their Medicaid-eligible population. So the decision raises a number of implementation issues going forward. Among these, first are the fact that some states delayed working to establish their exchanges while the litigation was pending. Will states be ready to establish their exchanges by 2014? The blueprints that they need to file with HHS are due in mid-November of this year. Next, will states enhance the federal funds available to comply with the Medicaid expansion? What options will exist for uninsured adults in states that do not comply with the Medicaid expansion? What guidance on implementing the ACA will the administration provide? And will Congress act to amend the ACA? I'll stop there. And turn it over to Alan and Tara.
Great. This is Alan Weil, Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. And with that really excellent explanation of what the court did, I want to turn my attention to three topics. First is, what are the implications for states? Second is, what do the federal officials need to do to keep implementation moving along? And third, offer a few thoughts about the role of philanthropy as the next phase of implementation of the ACA unfolds. Let's start with implications for states, and I should note I do not have any slides. I think the slides were very effective for presenting the opinion, but my presentation is not accompanied by slides. The most important statement to make about the implication for states is that mostly things are unchanged, as that means that basically, because the court upheld the law in full, states need to do the same things they needed to do a month ago, and all of the deadlines and timelines that we knew about over the last couple of years remain in place. It means that states that have been actively pursuing implementation need not adjust their activities or timelines because they remain unchanged. It also means that states that have held back from making decisions or taking steps to implement now confront deadlines that are quite real and coming up fairly quickly. So the overall implication is that the investments that states have made are paying off in terms of readiness, and it's time for the states that have taken fewer steps to make some tough decisions. There is, of course, one major twist, and that is the ruling with respect to Medicaid, which was really not anticipated by very many people, and it creates a set of questions for states that they did not anticipate. So let's just start with the most visible issue for states, which is the development of insurance exchanges. There are many maps and resources out there that indicate state progress implementing exchanges. I think the appropriate shorthand is to state that about a dozen states have been working quite consistently since enactment of the ACA, and they are essentially on track, confronting very real challenges, but overcoming them day by day to be ready to have the exchange operational within their state as of January 1st, 2014. There are about half a dozen states that from the outset have been quite clear that they have no intention of taking steps to develop an insurance exchange, and the expectation from the outset has been that if the law stands, the federal government will be responsible, as it is under the Affordable Care Act, for implementing the exchange within those states. But I think the most important point to make is that the vast majority of states sit in the middle. They have been undertaking planning and analytic efforts, some of them more visible, some of them more quietly, understanding that in this political environment they are not able to move forward in a serious way, but that they didn't want to be caught flat-footed in the event that the law remained in effect. And it's that vast group of states in the middle that I think are going to confront the biggest challenges with respect to moving forward, because time is not on their side. They need to make decisions and choices quite quickly in order to even have a possibility of implementing the major provisions of the law and not having the federal government step in and do it for them. Moving from the exchanges which have received the most visibility to the issue of Medicaid, as Mary Beth explained, the federal government cannot compel, under the court's decision, states to implement the expansion that was part of the Affordable Care Act. How have states reacted? Well, the early reactions from governors have not surprisingly split along fairly predictable partisan lines, with a handful of governors embracing the opinion, including the Medicaid expansion, a handful of governors very strongly opposing the decision that the court has made, and a number of governors saying it's really too early for them to analyze their options and know what steps they are going to take. State choices with respect to Medicaid will be made in the context of both substantive and political aspects. The substantive component is actually fairly straightforward. Under the Affordable Care Act, the vast majority of the cost of the Medicaid expansion is borne by the federal taxpayers, 100% of that cost in the first 3 years. But even the small amount that states do have to pay, which increases up to 10% in 7 years, that amount is on top of a Medicaid program that states are already really struggling to afford, and states are nervous about taking on an additional responsibility, even if the majority of the responsibility is borne by the federal taxpayer. And they are nervous that with the budget, federal budget discussions that are underway nationally, that the very favorable match rates in the ACA may not last. And so states are substantively concerned about whether or not they can afford this expansion. But certainly today, the largest reactions are political, and I think it's fair to say that governors are speaking out about the Medicaid expansion and taking positions on that expansion, largely consistently with the overall views of their respective political parties, whether they view the Affordable Care Act as something they want to be supportive of or something that they want to suggest is fundamentally flawed. So let me move to the second question, which is, what does the federal government need to do to keep implementation moving along? In the very short run, there are some critical issues of clarification that states require, and we can expect HHS to weigh in on these when they are ready. For example, the Medicaid expansion goes up to 133% of poverty. Will it be possible for states to pick a lower number, only covering people up to 50 or 100% of poverty? Will there be limitations on when states can come in or when they can leave? Do they have to expand in 2014? Could they wait until 2015? Could they do it just for the 3 years of full federal funding? Or do they have to lock themselves in for a longer period? All of these questions require clarification, and states are eager to hear the answers. I should note that we have a website sponsored by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation called statereforum.org. That's statereforum, R-E-F-O-R-U-M.org, and we are compiling state questions and reactions to the decision. And we have, at this point, also formal communication from the Governors Association, the Medicaid directors, to HHS asking a long list of questions, but the ones I mentioned are the core questions. In the more intermediate timeline, basically I think the challenge facing HHS will be to calibrate how much discretion they give states versus how much guidance and requirements they put on states. At the moment, states are really challenged by the number of issues they have to analyze and consider. And so while the mantra is always give states choices, choices also require time and effort to resolve. And states now face an entirely new choice that they did not anticipate just a few weeks ago, which is whether or not to expand their Medicaid programs. And so I think as we move into these final months leading up to implementation, HHS is really going to have to look carefully at the balance between how much state discretion they give states and how much definitive guidance they give. And then finally, the federal government is going to have to, of course, navigate the politics of particularly those states that are vocally opposing implementation of the law. We have already seen a number of states challenging the federal government's ability to enforce the so-called maintenance of effort provisions, which prevent states from cutting back their Medicaid eligibility until they have their exchanges up and running. From a legal interpretation perspective, I think it's pretty clear that the maintenance of effort provisions remain in effect after the Supreme Court's opinion. But despite that fairly clear conclusion, that's not going to prevent governors who oppose the law from seeking every opportunity to challenge HHS's interpretation of the law. And I think the federal government is really going to find itself on the receiving end of very many continuing legal and political attacks on the law, and that is going to dominate how HHS is handling implementation over the next, certainly, few months leading up to the election, but probably after that. And let me just close with a few thoughts about the role of philanthropy. I state these with some humility because I'm speaking to people who are expert in this area, and I am not, but I want to at least give you my thoughts in this area. First of all, many foundations have supported states directly. It is the case that the largest share of implementation activities rest with the states. And I would encourage continued support for states, but I would also note that there are a tremendous number of federal resources available to states now that were not available in the first days after enactment. And so foundations should be opportunistic in their support of state implementation activities and not assume that there's nothing that the state can get support for from the federal government. Many foundations have been involved in advocacy, not just at the broad policy level, but also at the more operational level to assure that implementation is effective, and supporting organizations that can really achieve a voice, provide a voice for consumers to make sure implementation occurs effectively. A small number of you have made major investments in supporting state and local media, and I do have to say the amount of state media attention on this issue is disappointingly small, and to the extent that we could expand the voice of real people and real on-the-ground activities as opposed to just national political spokespeople, I think that would be helpful. But to me, the major issue, the major area where philanthropy can really make a difference is in the, frankly, much more complex area of healthcare associated with reforming the delivery system, improving the delivery of care in ways that improve quality and outcomes and reduce cost. There are many provisions in the Affordable Care Act that are supportive of these changes, but they require long-standing commitments. They require communication and collaboration and convening. They're very challenging operational issues associated with improving the delivery of care and bringing a very diverse healthcare sector together in conversations that they're not accustomed to having. In the limited resources environment that states operate in today, they are focused so heavily on the coverage aspects that the federal government is paying for and simply don't have the resources to yield the long-term improvements that we all need that will also make the system hopefully more sustainable from a cost basis. This is less partisan, and it does require exactly the kind of strengths that philanthropy brings. So I would really encourage you to move beyond the headlines of exchanges and into the much thornier, more complex, but in the long run more rewarding, I think, area of improving the delivery of care. And I would just close by noting that the Affordable Care Act asks the healthcare sector to fundamentally change how it does business, what its revenue models are, how it works with colleagues and patients and listens to others. And I would hope that the philanthropic sector could look in the mirror and realize that if we're asking that level of change in basic functioning from the healthcare sector, perhaps philanthropy also needs to get out of some of its models and think more broadly about a vision and transformation. I think that improvements in how philanthropy targets its resources can also yield improvements in the healthcare system, and that's what we're all working for. Sarah, I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah. Thank you, Alan. I will be very brief because between Mary Beth and Alan, they've done a tremendous job covering the main points. One observation and then a follow-on related to Alan's very good thoughts on philanthropy. I've written an article with Tim Westmoreland, which hopefully will be out in Health Affairs in the next several days. And just to sort of add a little bit to Alan's framing of the issues, I think that the Secretary has sort of three fundamental choices that loom in front of her, and we're just beginning to see a little bit about their thinking. A letter was released last night to the governors, which like, you know, sort of like reading the posters in Tiananmen Square, doesn't say a lot, but there are things that the letter does say that are important. And, of course, as Alan points out, because the imperative to get information out to states is so enormous, and because this particular Supreme Court decision has set off this huge new bolus of uncertainties, we can expect probably to see a fair amount of HHS issuance, some more cryptic, some less cryptic, in the coming days and weeks. So one is one of the options she has is to essentially simply say, look, there is a coverage group. The group gets added in 2014. It's a group that's described in the law. It consists of all individuals with incomes below a certain threshold who aren't already within one of a state's coverage groups, the required coverage groups, and therefore you can opt to do this, or you cannot. You can elect not to do it now because I have no mechanism for enforcing the requirements of the new coverage group. But there's the coverage group, take it or leave it. And that approach, which is a pretty hard-nosed approach, is, in my view, consistent with the decision itself. The decision itself says, look, we're not changing the Medicaid statute at all. Mm-hmm. We are not making a mandatory group optional. We are not moving one part of the statute to another part of the statute. We're not doing anything to redo Congress's handiwork. We're simply saying that one of the normal enforcement remedies that's available when a state does not comply with a mandatory provision of the statute is not available, and it's not available only for that part of the ACA's Medicaid expansions, and there are many, that deals with extension of coverage to poor adults, because that's the part of the ACA that, where Medicaid is concerned, is so transformational that, and this is the court talking now, no state could have anticipated such a sweeping change, and it is essentially a change that's a game changer for Medicaid. Everything else that the ACA does is not, I mean, it's very important and it's very valuable, former foster children or enrollment simplification, things like that, but it's not transformational the way the adult provisions are, the 100% federally funded adults. And so it may be that the Secretary takes a very, very, narrow legalistic reading of the law, and states have to decide whether to take it or leave it. The pros of doing that are it's a nice, narrow legalistic reading of the decision, and the cons obviously are that it hardly deals with the kinds of consequential problems that Alan has outlined. There's what the law says, and there's the practicalities of what a decision does. And so I think most people don't anticipate this kind of a very rigid approach, but it would be legal for her to do that. A second option she's got is to say, well, you know, really what the decision did was to reclassify this mandatory coverage group as an option. Typically, when states have options, We have created options within options. Congress even did this for the early adopter states in 2010. And so what we're going to do is let states do all the things that Alan was describing. We're going to let them phase slowly. We're going to let them phase by income level. We're going to let them start with some adults and not all adults. If they opt in, we'll let them recalibrate their coverage levels if the contributions start dropping, although, you know, it doesn't turn the option into a mandate once they take it. They can always back out. So essentially, the encouragement approach, very broad, very willing to work with states, inviting them to submit state plan amendments that describe what they're going to do. So this kind of, very soft around the edges response is something that I think has a lot of political appeal to it. The problem is that I don't think there's any legal support for that position. It's not what the court said. The court said we did not change the statute. The statute is not described in terms of soft, warm, and fuzzy, not after 2014. In the early adopter part of the statute, you can have lots of flexibility, but once 2014 comes, the statute describes a coverage group, and you gotta follow the coverage group. If you want the enhanced federal funding in the early adoption period, there is no enhanced federal funding. So the trade-off is we'll be nice and soft and warm and fuzzy. But after we're paying for this thing, we want everybody in or you don't get any of the money. So she doesn't really have much of a legal leg to stand on being quite so warm and fuzzy. On the other hand, she probably might like to be less rigid than the mandatory coverage group alone suggests. So the third option is maybe to use her considerable powers under federal Medicaid demonstration authority essentially start negotiations with individual states about what she will and will not allow. The demonstration authority is broad. The states have some bargaining room. She's got bargaining room. The problem with demonstration authority is, the obvious one, at some level you got to say to yourself, well, what's being demonstrated here? You know, the statute says we want these people covered. What are we demonstrating? How it's possible to cover fewer than everybody? What's the demonstration? Where's the research design? Is this just wholesale waiver of an existing law? You know, what's going on here? There have been legal challenges to 1115 demonstrations that have been successful. And so you're sort of left racking your brain, well, is this demo material or not? I think, the early consensus is that it certainly lends itself to demo authority, but the terms of demo authority land are not yet fleshed out. The only other thing I would add to Alan's observations about the role of funders is, based on the calls that we are getting here, I would say that there is a very fast and very urgent need for quick money, quick turnaround money to assist in the kind of rapid analysis that's going to be needed for the state legislatures decide whether to move forward and if so, how. So, for example, we received a call from one state yesterday looking for quick help. The governor's office has done one analysis of the cost exposure to the mandate. The legislature apparently looks with great skepticism at the analysis. The legislature wants more analyses, and it's probably going to want even more analyses as the secretary lays some more options out. So I would say that in addition to all of the help Alan outlined, there are a lot of states are going to need help for lawmakers or policy advocates, very rapid analysis funding to figure out what the meaning of the implementing guidelines is as they're coming down the path, and the cost of various state options. So why don't I stop there?
Thank you very much, all three of you. Anne, can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, good, very good. Thank all of you. This was a very meaty bite, very concisely shared with us of the challenges that come out of this decision. but making it much clearer what some of the options might be going forward. And I really appreciate the suggestions of the roles that philanthropy can play. And now I want to open it up for the group for questions for our speakers or comments. Views from different parts of the country, and if you see things playing out in certain ways that you think would be valuable for your colleagues to know about, please share those. I'm assuming with the number of beeps I heard and the crowd that we have on the call that we will have no problem with people diving right in. If we do, we've got a few of you that we're going to call on. And what I'm going to do in terms of facilitation is hand it over now to Osula Rushing to manage this from our office in Washington. Osula, I assume you're there.
I am.
Excellent. Thank you. Anybody want to start off the discussion?
I believe there is a few questions in the queue, so let me just remind people that there are two ways to ask a question. You can type your question into the chat box in the lower right-hand corner of your screen, or you can click the raise hand icon above that box to indicate that you'd like to be called on. And when your name is called, you'll need to press star 6 to unmute your line, introduce yourself, and if possible, mention for which speaker your question is intended. So our first question is from Wendy Wolf from the Maine Health Access Foundation. Wendy?
Thanks, Osula. I hope I'm unmuted.
You are.
Thank you. And for those of you who are not familiar with where Maine is falling on this description, we are in one of the states where we have a governor who is not supportive of moving forward on exchanges. So our tactic, thank you, Alan, has been to focus on the broader health care delivery system reforms and really plunge deeply into that. So I appreciate the support that your suggestion for the role philanthropy can play. But I do have a question about whether any of the speakers see implications for the basic health plan and any possible modifications that might be contemplated given sort of the flux now under this new Medicaid situation. Does it strengthen, or do you see any potential alteration of the benefits of basic health plan? I know it covers different individuals and income categories, but that would be helpful for us to know. Thank you.
Alan, do you want to take a crack? Mary Beth? I can start. It's Sarah. The basic health program is an interesting option. It's a special state option to essentially build a bridging program between Medicaid eligibility and individuals with household incomes at about twice the federal poverty level. The program would essentially allow a single, really pooled arrangement consisting of Medicaid beneficiaries and this near-poor group of people. States would receive premium subsidies from the federal government with certain adjustments and could use their Medicaid financing. They could align their Medicaid financing with this premium subsidy financing to set up a program that looks not unlike the Washington State Basic Health Program. This was sponsored by one of Washington's senators, and clearly this bridging program was what she had in mind. The immediate issue is that the way the basic health program is defined, it's defined in relation to not Medicaid eligibility, which would let you take your Medicaid program maybe and align it with the basic health program subsidies. It's defined in relation to family income. So it's for people with incomes at 133% of poverty to 200% of poverty. So if your Medicaid program goes up to 133% of poverty, then this option actually makes some sense. I've done some writing on this with Ben Summers and Nan Huang. We actually think that one of the small benefits of going this route might be that it would cut down on churning that otherwise will happen at the Medicaid exchange point of interaction. But it only works, really, in states that have the Medicaid floor in place. and then want to think about whether to add on the basic health program, step into the individual shoes, get the federal subsidies, put the program together, and simply charge a sliding premium scale of some form. So in states that are thinking, well, maybe we'll just skip the Medicaid expansion and take the basic health program option, this is a problem because you won't have any money for that space between your current program and 133% of poverty.
Yeah, this is Alan. I will just say I think Sarah's got it exactly right, that if one of the primary benefits of building a basic health program is to smooth transitions, if there's nothing that you're transitioning from,
right,
that advantage is no longer valid, which isn't to say that there aren't some other potential advantages and, of course, some other potential disadvantages. But in terms of how the environment has changed as a result of the opinion, I think that the primary change is that a state that is not looking to expand Medicaid would have a hard time figuring out what the rationale is for doing a basic health program. I will say, and this is probably so obvious it doesn't need to be said, what the court did does sort of affect some of the logic and the pieces of the Affordable Care Act that might lend themselves to statutory fixes. You could see Congress coming in and saying, well, if the Medicaid expansion is voluntary, we ought to make these three changes to the law to make it rational again. And, of course, the odds of that happening right now are zero. And so what we have to deal with is a change in the structure without any ability to recalibrate from a federal legal perspective other than what the Secretary can do through regulations, as Sarah described some of the question about how much room she has. But basic questions like how might we deal with a gap in coverage for low-income people, the lowest-income people who might get no subsidy while people at a higher income level would, that's not going to get fixed anytime soon.
Thank you so much. Our second question is from Billy Hall of the Sunflower Foundation in Kansas. So, Billy, can you take your phone off mute by pressing star 6 and take it away?
Okay. Ms. Suma?
Yes.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, if you could just speak a little bit louder.
Okay, I will do that. Well, thanks to all of our speakers. I really appreciated the summary and their thoughts and recommendations to us in the field. I guess I want to just say a couple things and see what kind of reaction I get. We're obviously in a state that probably is still going to be standing still even after the decision. So, you know, we have to take a look at what we can do, and I like the idea, and we have been working on the improvement of the delivery of care. But I know that many of the lawmakers in Kansas, we kind of have an administration and a governor who has a very strong opinion, and mostly our legislature is in the same place, but not all of them. And I think I'm starting to hear questions from members of our legislature about the consequences for not doing anything. And I think if there's anything that could be helpful for us who are working in these kind of situations is to sort of have the clarity of a talking point sort of scenario, because I believe there are a lot of members, policy members here who are confused about the consequences for staying put and just simply taking the federal exchange, and also the real consequences besides the obvious of not expanding Medicaid. What are the other consequences of the expansion? We had a conversation in Kansas about DSH hospitals and some of the consequences there. So I guess I'm mostly wanting some of the talking points that will help inform some of our decision makers, and I'll just leave it at that.
If I could start on that, it's hard to do this in talking point form, but because it's complicated, but I guess I just want to say two things as quickly as I can get them out. The first is, I do want to acknowledge that it may not be a bad decision for a state not to do the exchange. I don't feel that way about the Medicaid expansion, but the fact is this is not kindergarten level work. And if the state doesn't want to do it and doesn't want to do it right, it may be better for the citizens of the state for the federal government to do it. And so I don't want us to feel that the only form of success here is that all 50 states set up exchanges. I've felt that from the very beginning. Ray Shapock, when he was the director of the National Governors Association, and I wrote a piece on that right after the law was enacted. This is not a litmus test for the quality of implementation. That said, the one talking point that I don't hear said enough, because there are, you know, there's sort of the broad political, do you really want Washington running something in your state? And that pushes back on the ideology. The one issue that I think has gotten totally lost, and Billy, I appreciate, and Wendy, you, before you, the emphasis on delivery system, is that the biggest lost opportunity for a state that does not operate an exchange is the ability to coordinate efforts to improve the delivery of care across different purchasers. And I'm in Oregon right now as I'm talking to you, and Oregon is leading the country in figuring out how to use the leverage of Medicaid, of private purchasers, of the exchange as they bring it up, of state employees to come together and send a consistent message to the delivery system about what the expectations are with respect to quality and outcomes and metrics and cost. And you can only do that if you bring everyone to the table. The biggest loss of deferring to the federal government in the insurance rating side and insurance rate enforcement side and in the exchange is that the federal government is not going to have the local knowledge. It doesn't have the capacity to do anything more than basically run the website and make sure people get the right coverage and get their tax credits. They are not going to have the resources to participate in a local discussion and the local agreements that you need to improve care. And I would think that would resonate with people on the side of the politics of this who are not so enthusiastic about other aspects of the Affordable Care Act. That it's not just about federal intrusion. It's about a lost opportunity. Now, you have to believe that that opportunity has meaning, and I do, and maybe some people don't. But if in your states where you've actually been doing the groundwork to get people talking about improving how care is organized and delivered, and you've done that, then it seems to me that this talking point ought to work, and it's the one I feel most strongly about.
The only point I would add, I think Alan is totally correct, the only point I would add is that, of course, in the world of states that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, reach the sensible conclusion that they don't want to set up their own exchanges, I was one of the, early on, I was asking everybody I could think of, why would any state bother to do this? Why wouldn't they just have the federal government come in and set up the eligibility and enrollment machinery for them, for the individuals? And one of the options under the federal regulations is, in fact, what Mary Beth, is sort of a partnership where essentially certain functions, some of the more ministerial functions of accepting applications and calculating people's household incomes and determining which program you're supposed to go into to get your affordability benefits, all of that can be carried out by, say, the federal government, but that the true thinking about the big issues Alan was just identifying, who's a qualified health plan, who gets to bid, who gets to sell in the exchange, under what circumstances, you know, what measurements are we going to use across our Medicaid employee benefit and qualified health plan markets to sort of nudge all the plans and the networks in certain directions. All of that can still be very much a state function, even if the federal government is moving the levers around on affordability programs. And the only other thing I would observe, because this too has spun out of all control here in Washington, is that the law is very clear that the state exchange is the state exchange. So it's like the fact that I'm an employee of GW. I'm in the GW health plan. The fact is that United runs the GW health plan, but I'm not in the United health plan. I'm in the GW health plan. If Virginia decided not to go through the mechanics of setting up its exchange, The fact of the matter is that as a Virginia resident, I would be enrolling in Virginia's exchange. I wouldn't think of it as the national exchange. It would be Virginia's exchange, and it wouldn't matter to me whether the man behind the curtain was the federal government's contractor or Virginia's contractor. And because we are being so rigid about functionalities versus legalities here, we're missing this bigger picture of states ought to be taking the most expedient way they can at this point to get the mechanics into place, whether they're doing it, whether they want the federal government to do some of it for them, and think about getting the benefits out of, as Alan was describing, of having this thing up and running and making a market for themselves.
Great. Our next question is from Sandra Shuri from the California Healthcare Foundation. Sandra? You'll need to take your phone off mute by pressing star 6.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
So I my question has to do with whether or not anything about the decision impacts the ACA emphasis on simplification for Medicaid and the enrollment processes, if there's just anything we should be concerned about or aware of in that arena.
This is Mary Beth, and I think a careful read of the decision shows that the court was very careful to talk about the Medicaid expansion. Justice Roberts cites, the citation that he uses is to that group that talks about expanding Medicaid coverage up to 133% of poverty for low-income adults. And so there's quite a lot of provisions in the ACA that relate to Medicaid in many, many different areas. And so the court's decision did not address those and, in fact, says that all of the language of the ACA remains in place. So obviously, while we need to await further guidance from the Secretary, enrollment simplification, I think it's safe to say at this point, was not affected by what the court decided about the Secretary's ability to enforce compliance with the Medicaid expansion.
So this is Alan. I completely agree with Mary Beth. The only twist that I don't think applies to you in California, but others definitely should be aware of around the country, is that many, many states are in the midst of fundamentally redesigning their eligibility systems around the simplification that you refer to and around the Medicaid expansion. And to the extent that there are many states now where political leaders have said we're either not going to do the expansion or we're not sure if we're going to do the expansion, although many of the simplification steps can be continued because, for example, the conversion to modified adjusted gross income certainly goes forward. There's this sort of big hole in your planning, which is, are we going to be building an eligibility module for these people or not? And particularly if, as Sarah described, the Secretary gives states some flexibility about how far up the scale they go if they don't want to go all the way to 133, those issues could be pended for quite some time. So for those of you in states where the expansion is uncertain, I do think that it throws a bit of a wrench into the broader efforts to redesign eligibility systems. Hopefully most of that work can continue, but this is a little bit of a twist that could affect the pace at which states can move on that work.
Thanks.
Our next question is from Rose Johnson of the Devil's Lake Area Foundation in North Dakota, and her question is, how is the IRS going to monitor who has or does not have health insurance?
We're sitting and thinking at our end.
Hearing silence makes me think. I mean, to my knowledge, and this is pretty thin, I think the expectation is not too different from what Massachusetts has done, which is to basically require the various sources of coverage, the carriers, to issue some sort of documentation to tax filers about the nature of their coverage that then would be electronically or physically appended to the tax return that would be proof of coverage. I think that that's conceptually the way IRS intends to approach it, but I will admit this is not the part of implementation I focus the most on, so I don't want to pretend to more knowledge than I have.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I was going to say, that for the first time, the Internal Revenue Service, in theory, will have information from filers about the status of their coverage. The problem is that, of course, there's a federal income tax filing threshold of about, I don't know, slightly under $10,000 for one and $20,000 for a family. So it's not going to get you information on what may be the most vulnerable group of all, which is poor people. I don't know that we have anything better to go on than the health interview survey and other national, you know, statistical studies that are done.
Our next question is from Miguel Colado, who is from the William T. Grant Foundation in New York. His question is, most information I've read about this new law states that for organizations with fewer than 25 employees, the change will be very minimal. What changes should our organization, which is tax-exempt, be focusing on going forward from an employer's perspective?
Well, for a small employer, Sarah, you're under the 50-employer threshold. So you don't have to pay a penalty if you don't provide insurance and your employees go into the exchange. Speaking as the mother-in-law of someone who was a small employer in New York City in the theater world, they were jumping up and down for joy when the law first took effect, because for the first time they're low, you know, theater company, so it's a low-wage company. They were suddenly insurable for the first time. They could buy a policy. They could buy a group policy. So small employers generally, I think, are sort of in the catbird seat. They get tax credits for buying, and they're exempt from any of the penalties.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think there are changes in benefit standards that apply to everyone. It would be surprising to me if I were to learn that as a foundation, you aren't already in compliance with all of those. And then, of course, there are rating changes that apply to everybody. The funny thing about this law, and I don't want to over-represent my two colleagues here, is that there's sort of a whole health policy analysis side, and then there is sort of the employee benefit manager side of this, and we get information from them, and they really do look at the law differently than us policy wonks. So I do think your usual sources of information about employee benefits and what the implications of the legal change are probably going to tap you into a deeper root of knowledge about the implications than someone like me who really takes it more from a policy perspective.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if you're a small employer, then you're undoubtedly buying insurance. It's typically in most places pretty hard to self-insure. And so there you would want to go to your health benefit consulting group, if you have one, and find out what the new law means. And as Alan says, it would, assuming you didn't have coverage before and you're not dealing with the world of grandfathered plans, it's going to mean that the products that you're buying are a little bit different. And someday, if you're a small low-wage employer, you may actually get help buying the product. This is the weird thing about this law, I must just stop and say, which I think has struck everybody on the call, which is for the vast majority of us, I mean, the adage that if you like what you have, you can keep it is not so terribly off the mark. Nothing but nothing is going to happen to me at GW or probably Mary Beth at Kaiser, except that we have to check an additional box when we file our tax returns, and our benefits and our cost sharing maybe, you know, different in some small but important ways.
Our next question is from Lisa Block of the Healthcare Foundation of New Jersey. What is the public process for the governor in pursuing options short of full compliance? Is it through the Medicaid waiver process?
This, Alan, I'll take a quick stab at this. This is actually, I think, the most interesting issue that I wrote about a little bit in my blog post in Health Affairs, which is I actually think that one of the biggest challenges confronting states over the next particularly 6 months to a year, is going to be an issue of governance. There is no federal legal standard for how states develop their policies in the healthcare arena or, frankly, in the Medicaid arena. You really have to look to your own state constitution and history with respect to statutes to determine who gets to make these decisions. There are new federal standards for when a state submits a waiver that have really to do with transparency, but again, not so much to do with governance. So, for example, I'm certainly familiar with a few states where any change in Medicaid eligibility has to be done through statute. There are budget implications, which, to my knowledge, in every state are done through some sort of a statutory gubernatorial process. So part of why I don't read too much into governors' statements within the first 24 hours of release of the opinion about what they're going to do on Medicaid is that they are not the only decision maker in this arena. So I guess my bottom line would be I think it's very hard to generalize. Some of this is politics and some of it is, you know, state-level constitutional history and practice, but these are major consequential decisions. We saw some of this tension play out around, you saw Mary Beth's slide showing that in some states, states were on both sides of the lawsuit because different branches of government took different views of the law. My concern is that time is now running out, and so there, regardless of the process, there does have to be a decision made. And default is problematic, and yet that's, I think, where many states are going to be. So I can't really answer it from any individual state's perspective, but I think within your own state you can certainly determine whether or not Medicaid eligibility standards in particular, which is what's most in controversy, as well as exchange creation, is something that has to be done through statute or, as some states have done, more through executive order or administrative order.
Splendid. Well, thank you so much. We are 1 minute over, and so I wanted to just really thank our speakers who covered a huge amount of ground in a short amount of time. Mary Beth, Sarah, and Alan, thank you so much. I also want to thank our partners at the Council on Foundations. I think it was a very good call, and I really appreciate your partnering with us on it. I want to thank everyone who called in, especially those who asked questions. With over 150 people on the line, there were several questions that we didn't have time to get to, and what I'm going to ask you to do is to send your questions to healthreform@gih.org, and we will make sure to get answers from the speakers for those of the questions that we couldn't get to. So thank you so much to everyone for participating and to our speakers for sharing your expertise. Following this webinar, we'll be sending out a list of resources and links for those who would like to read more, and we'll be posting a recording of this webinar and its slides on our website in the coming weeks. So have a wonderful week, everybody. Thank you.